The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly. This week, we're going to focus on a few stories from the history of science and medicine. First up, human-to-human transplants and intensive care medicine. These are one of the greatest successes of post-war medicine, but they also raise some of the most profound ethical and clinical questions. Doctors Kevin Fong and Richard Barnett are here to discuss how these important medical interventions started and, crucially, where they're going. The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, is also on hand. He'll be trawling through some of the long-held secrets behind the Piltdown hoax of 1912. That rocked the scientific establishment. And now a new generation of researchers wants to find out the truth. Who was behind the hoax? Plus, we explore some of this week's news. With two major science journals voluntarily suspending publication of studies into bird flu, we ask, should scientific research ever be censored? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio today, we've got the author of a book called Sick City, the medical historian Richard Barnett, and we've also got long-term friend of the pod and occasional guest host, the consultant anaesthetist Kevin Fong. Let's start with the events you're curating for the Royal Institution. You're both Wellcome Trust Engagement Fellows, so the subject matter is, of course, biological medical. Richard, can you start by telling us about the origins of heart transplants?
Well, historians always, as you know, want to take everything back to Adam. But I think if we're thinking about transplants and heart transplants in particular, the time and place to go back to is Paris at the end of the 18th century. It's a dramatic change in Western surgery at this time. Up to this point, disease has always been conceptualized as a kind of imbalance, whether it's an imbalance of humors or nervous spirits flowing around the body. Now, in that model of medicine, the organs themselves really aren't that important. There's no point cutting out an organ and replacing it with another one because it's about the flow through them. It's about the movement, the dynamism that's important. What happens in the hospitals of Paris at the time of the French Revolution is that the human body is radically reconceptualized. Disease is seen not as a kind of imbalance, but as a specific structural lesion, defect in a particular kind of tissue. And that's where the origin of so much modern medicine and modern surgery comes from, the idea that the way to cure a disease is to cut it out. Now, through the 19th century, you get some very important technical developments. Anesthesia, I suppose, most importantly. It's rather difficult to carry out a four-hour heart operation if the patient is lying there on the table screaming their heads off. Yeah. Exactly. But even by the start of the 20th century, there are still some major obstacles to it. Elite Western surgeons and doctors are not at all happy with the idea of specialisation. There's a very ancient idea in medicine that says that a good doctor is a generalist. Medicine is a kind of learned, humane art. The doctor should be able to know everything about all of disease and all of the human body. And specialisation is in some ways rather vulgar and technical. It's something that sort of mechanics do, as it were. So there's a great professional resistance to the kind of specialisation that you need to start doing heart operations. But this starts to break down in the 20th century, partly because you get new kinds of state funding that are setting up new kinds of training and research establishments, so you get the development of specialist skills, partly also because of two world wars, frankly. The experience of Western doctors in these two world wars really demonstrates very powerfully and vividly that specialist knowledge is required.
So are they developing brand new techniques continually?
Yes, exactly. War is, in strange ways, very good for medicine. It's a kind of intensive training course, if you like. So a lot of important techniques come out of the two world wars. But there are some very important techniques that come through in the interwar period. Firstly, and in some ways it sounds rather strange, if you're going to transplant organs, you need very, very fine technical skills. You need to be able to reconnect very fine vessels together. And it's a French surgeon called Alexis Carrel in the 1910s, 1920s, who basically goes to the lace makers of Lyon and says, you guys know how to do very fine stitching, teach me how to do it. So he comes up with the new techniques required to plumb in organs that are being replaced. And finally, I suppose the really important thing is the immune system. As soon as doctors start doing any kind of transfusion or transplantation, as far back as the 1660s, it's very clear that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, whether it's blood transfusions or bits of organs being implanted. What's crucially done in the 30s and especially in the 40s is that the immune system is worked out. why rejection happens and what you can do about it. So by the 1950s, you have the technical skill, you have the specialist knowledge, and you have the ability to suppress the immune system. That's what really creates the context for heart surgery.
So the emerging thing there is to replace organs, you've got the skills. Kevin, how radical was this at the time for doctors?
Well, it's interesting because on top of all of that, you realise that the heart as an organ is regarded as largely inviolate by the medical and surgical fraternity, even at the start of last century. And going through World War One, you have these quite heroic accounts of surgeons being unsure of what to do, confronted with a man with a heart wound, uncertain whether or not to operate, because actually the luminaries of the time said to do so, to operate on the heart was to lose the respect of everybody, to be seen as a maverick. And it really takes both world wars, as Richard said, both world wars to change that perspective, because faced with a dying patient with a piece of shrapnel or a bullet in their heart, the option of doing nothing is no option at all. So you get the technology coming together, the skills coming together, but also you get this overwhelming sort of flood of casualties from this mechanized war that pushes you into this corner that says, you've got to do something now, and this is the time at which all of this has to come together and give rise to a new subspeciality.
Richard, you mentioned something about the surgeons not really willing to specialise. Over what period did they start to do that and become these specialists in particular organs or particular techniques?
It's really through the late 19th and early 20th century. I suppose certainly by 1950 you've got very clear surgical specialities emerging. But it's difficult to overestimate the kind of opposition that specialization faced. As I said, for a long time in Western medicine, the good doctor is the generalist, and so specialists are seen as in some ways inferior. The joke almost is that if you're specializing in the foot, you don't know anything about the rest of the body. You become just this very sort of technical expert. Just to follow up on what Kevin was saying, I think there's a really nice illustration of the way that surgeons and indeed the wider culture thought about the heart from a rather unusual source. If you look at the kind of letters of condolence that trench commanders wrote to the parents of people who had been killed, very often they will contain the line, "He was shot through the heart and died instantly." Now, this is supposed to be a sort of consoling story. It's a heroic and, crucially, it's an immediate and painless death. Now, of course, with modern physiology, we know that if you shoot somebody in the heart, of course, they don't die instantly. But it reflects this belief that the heart was the seat of life and that to interfere with it could lead to instantaneous death.
The other thing that you're going to be talking about at the Royal Institution, the other big subject, something closer to your heart, Kevin, is intensive care. Where did this start to emerge? And again, I mean, you mentioned the wars. How important were they in developing these techniques?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how important war was as a stimulus, but I was struck really when we started looking, Richard and I, at things that we might explore, that these big iconic bits of medical practice that we have from last century that we now take for granted really had such difficult beginnings, and what called them into being isn't necessarily what we use them for today. And with intensive care, it mostly comes about from the polio epidemic of the 1950s. Famously, people talk about Copenhagen, where you have polio virus sweeping through Europe and giving people a grisly, slow, drawn-out death from paralysis and respiratory failure. The sudden realization that perhaps, given that this might be a disease that was in some cases self-limiting, that if you could support the patient for long enough, that you might provide some survival advantage. And so they began ventilating these patients, so artificially supporting an organ system, in this case the lungs. And the 1950s saw these shifts of medical students ventilating people with a bag, with a tube that was either going in through the mouth or through the throat. That's when they first realised that supporting organs might be of some advantage in trying to get you through the worst of a disease. And of course, as time's gone on and we've rolled into this century, we can support everything. We support lungs with ventilation, we support hearts with drugs and mechanical devices, we support kidneys externally, you know, with machines that sit next to the patient and do the job of a kidney. They've had a go at doing it with livers, albeit with less success. You now have the modern intensive care unit, which is this hugely technologically advanced bit of the hospital with kit bristling all around the patient, buying an opportunity for them to recover.
in a sense, as you say, it's a very central part of many hospitals, these intensive care units, very high resource there. What's the sort of thinking around the cost effectiveness of something like this? Intensive care is possible because you've got all this equipment, but how often do doctors and people who run hospitals think about how cost effective something like this is?
Well, that's the key issue, isn't it? That you take an entity for which the survival rate is zero and you make it survivable, but in its place you put people who may either take longer to die or suffer lifelong disability as a result, and then the health economics are difficult to get your head around there, really. I mean, in some cases it doesn't make economic sense to invest huge amount of resource.
How much longer would a person who's in intensive care be living? I mean, these people are going to be ill anyway when they go in. Are they living for years longer, months longer? What's the...
Well, it's different. Modern intensive care is a bit more nuanced now. We try and get in earlier. Even when I started close to 15 years ago, intensive care was kind of the last resort place that you called. You know, if someone was really, really sick on the wards and you'd really done everything you could, you called the intensivists and they came and they scooped your patient up and they disappeared into a room and they very often didn't come out again. And there's the recognition now that we should be getting in earlier and sort of not shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted. But nevertheless, we're getting better at choosing who we take to intensive care and when we intervene, but nevertheless, it's an expensive resource. It's the most expensive bed in the hospital per night because of all the therapies and the staffing requirements. And there is that question of at what point is enough enough? And that's very difficult to know. That is one of the key ethical dilemmas for that speciality.
So intensive care is there at the centre of hospitals. What about heart transplants? How routine, if I can use that word, is that now?
I mean, routine's to put too fine a point on it. It's still a huge intervention, but the state of the art is such that there is a very reasonable expectation of success and survival in those cases today. And that contrasts very, very, very sharply with the early days of it. I mean, the early days of heart transplantations had some pretty awful statistics in terms of morbidity and mortality, so much so that after a few short years of the practice, moratoriums were put in place to stop this activity until we'd got our head round why the mortality was so high. And that also partly interests me in terms of, I mean, you know, when you look at the origins of modern medical specialities, actually how dark some of the origins were, and it's questionable whether or not you can get that stuff going today if that was going to be how difficult it was at the start.
So, Richard, I mean, that's an interesting point, actually. There's some of this stuff which we intimated came from times where, you know, you were allowed to maybe take more risks than now. What were some of those origins?
Well, I think this touches nicely on a phrase that Kevin used when he was talking earlier about heart transplant, which is the desire to do something. That a lot of developments in Western medicine and Western surgery come out of this desire to be active, this desire not to watch your patients die in front of you, to have some sort of intervention. And it may seem an obvious point to make in some ways, but not only is this the origin of much that is great about Western medicine, it can be the origin of much that is very sort of dark and retrograde about medicine, that doctors faced with almost momentary ethical decisions to make, faced with patients dying in front of them, faced with what they see as epidemics of diseases or great social problems, the kind of action they can take is not always something that, shall we say, modern ethicists would look back on and praise. Certainly in the case of the first few heart transplants, I think, as Kevin said, it is inconceivable that they would be performed under modern regimes of medical ethics. But then again, most of those regimes of medical ethics came out of exactly these sort of
questions. What are you talking about? What kinds of things? Are we talking about patient consent?
Patient consent, and I think broadly speaking, the fact that there was very little idea of how this was going to happen. An ITU consultant I studied under was very strong that you should only ever let a patient into ITU if you have a strategy for getting that patient out of ITU. And I think something of that applies in the case of heart transplants. I don't think Barnard had a sense of where he was going with this. I think he thought it was an operation that would have long-term possibilities, but I think he felt that in the first few cases, it was just something that you had to follow, you had to watch, you had to do your best, and you would just have to see how it goes.
But they have to start somewhere.
They have to start somewhere, but when you read the accounts of it, you've got to remember then that coming up even into the middle of World War II, people are hesitant to operate on the substance of the heart, and it's only really all of those injuries that brings that into being, that says, do you know what, you can take a knife to a heart and the patient can survive and you're not necessarily a maverick for doing so. So that's 1945, you're getting to the realisation that you can do that. Then there's this proliferant phase of about the next 10, 15 years where they operate on everything inside the heart, every valve they can find, every structure they can find. And then they think, well, let's just try and replace the whole thing. And that would happen in about 20 years after they decided that it was okay to even go near it is incredible. And the rate of progress, I think, wouldn't have been possible today with the restrictions that are imposed by ethics. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing is a discussion point.
It's no coincidence that this period of very intense development took place when it did. I mean, we're talking here the 15, 20 years after the end of the Second World War. This is the high point of Western biomedicine. This is penicillin, this is Vannevar Bush publishing Science, the Endless Frontier. This is the idea that medicine and science are forces for unquestioned forces for good and forces for progress in global life and culture. And I think it's no surprise that surgeons are sort of influenced by that mentality. You know, I mean, I think for better or worse, probably for better, we have a much more equivocal view of science and medicine, perhaps a much more realistic view these days, which does shape the kind of experimentation, the kind of research that can be done. But I think it's no surprise that it was done in this period when penicillin made everybody think that Western medicine had a genuine possibility of ending all disease, ending all suffering.
So looking towards the future then, in the next few decades, do you expect a similar rate of progress, or will careful risk management sort of strategies that medics nowadays take, rightfully, will that sort of slow down progress and take these two areas particularly?
You could argue that if we did not have heart transplants today, heart transplantation hasn't happened yet. Everything around medicine has but that. I would be willing to bet a lot of money you wouldn't have it in 10 or 15 years' time from now. And yet that's what really happened originally. They first decided they wanted to transplant hearts, and within 10 or 15 years, they'd done it. Progress is slower now, but it's slower because you need to put protections in place, and we mustn't forget that around the time that these great, huge quantum leaps were being made in surgery to effect the first transplants, at the same time, atrocities were occurring in the United States, the Tuskegee syphilis scandal. So the protections are necessary. So there was sort of like, I don't quite want to say golden age, because it wasn't that golden, but it was an age that a lot of cultural factors, technological factors, and events of history had to coincide to make that thing happen in that short space of time.
It was a golden age for individual surgeons having the freedom to experiment. I think whether it was a golden age for medicine as a culture and political entity is very different. It's interesting to compare in some ways the heart and the brain. We now think of the brain as a much more delicate and complex organ. But if you look at the history of major operations on the brain, people start doing that from the very end of the 19th century. So 50 years before they're starting to get inside the heart, you've got people, I mean, Harvey Cushing, most famously in the US, doing some very delicate and very invasive operations on the brain. And then during the early 20th century, you've got lobotomy as well. Major brain surgery, as we would now see it, being done in the front rooms of consultants, you know, going in through the eyelids and sort of severing bits of the cortex. So it's striking that the organ which we now see as symbolising ourselves, as our core, as the centre of ourself, the brain, is actually something that surgeons were really quite sort of knife happy with in the early 20th century.
But I think that was partly born out of just the raw dynamism of the thing. I mean, part of the reason...
But in that case, why the brain and not the heart? Why not every organ? I think there's an interesting sort of cultural shift in emphasis from the brain to the heart, sort of from the heart to the brain, perhaps.
But and I'm only guessing at this, but faced with the heart as a structure in life, it is a dynamic organ. It changes state from second to second, less than that. And the early accounts are full of their surprise at how difficult it was to palpate anything within it in systole when it was contracting. But, you know, you had to sort of do a lot of this stuff with the phase of the heart. Mm. And indeed that there are, discussions of people trying to suture wounds of the heart and keep their finger on the spot where the thing was bleeding. They just couldn't keep their finger on the spot because the heart was beating so vigorously. So in terms of a practical problem for surgery, a piece of viscera that sits inside a box and stays still is probably an easier target than one that's moving constantly.
Even describing surgery on the brain makes me slightly wince. Going through eyelids, goodness. I hope they don't do that now, do they? You've got two events at the Royal Institution in middle and end of February. Who will they see if people come along?
We're very fortunate for our event about hearts to have Sir Terence Miles, who was a South African surgeon who worked in the UK and performed the first heart transplants in the surgery and did an awful lot to get over that very difficult period when there was so much mortality and morbidity. We've got Francis Wells, a cardiothoracic surgeon from Papworth, to bring us up to date with where we are and where we're headed.
We've also got Antonia Cronin, who's an ethicist, who's specialised in the ethics of kidney transplant, renal transplant as well.
And how about the second session on intensive care?
So for the ITU event, we're very lucky to have Dr. Nicholas Hirsch of Queen Square Medical ITU, so that's the National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery, and Dr. Simon Cohen, who is now retired but was one of my consultants when I was training as a registrar at the Middlesex Hospital. And to bring us up to date there, we've got Fiona Kelly, who works in Bath and who has just begun as a consultant and faces a future in which we're beginning to ask this question about what the resource limitations are, what are the ethics, where is the justice in treating people and pouring huge resource into them when the outcome may not be favourable.
So what we're going to try and do with these sessions is to try and cover the past, present and future of these developments. Where did they come from? What are the current challenges and where do we think we'll be with these ideas over the next generation or two? And the idea is to be as open-ended as possible. We're hoping it will segue into a discussion involving not only the panellists but also the audience. This is a real opportunity to come down and discuss these very live issues in modern medicine.
Richard, Kevin, thanks very much for all of that. You can hear the debates that these guys are organising for the Royal Institution. Hearts to Heart is on 15th February, and From Iron Lungs to Intensive Care is on the 28th of February. For more details, go to ri.ac.uk. So let's move on to some of the stories attracting our attention this week. Also joining us in the pod now is Robin McKee, the Observer's science editor. Kevin, the story you've brought along is something that's been rumbling on for a few weeks now. It's about whether you should censor publication of scientific information, specifically the H5N1 flu virus.
Well, it's this ongoing debate that's being had amongst virologists about whether or not these scientists who have engineered H5N1 influenza strains so that they might be more efficiently transmitted between mammals and therefore people.
And this is for experimental purposes.
For experimental purposes. There's two different laboratories that have been working on this and have got publications that are accepted for publication by, I think, Nature and Science. There's been a massive outcry with people saying on both sides that this stuff should be out there in the public domain. We should be publishing everything. And people are saying, well, you're just playing into the hands of people who want to create the ultimate bio weapon for terrorist use or otherwise. It's interesting to me because usually when you get a scare story of this type, it's usually public perception and fear of something that doesn't really exist, and actually the scientists who are doing the work saying, well, there's nothing to worry about here. But here the community of virologists are pretty much split, I mean, almost down the middle on whether or not they think you should give an instruction manual to people on how to engineer a more virulent strain of one of the most deadly viruses we've seen for some time.
Is it an instruction manual? I mean, even if they had the sequence, I mean, how easy is it to build this thing and, you know, get it around?
Well, that's the argument, isn't it? I mean, in theory, the publications themselves contain enough core information that someone might emulate the work, but the people who are in favour of the publication say, you know, if you really wanted to do this, if you were a state that wanted to do state-sponsored bioweapon production like this, you probably don't need this paper to do this work. And if you're a bunch of kitchen privateers trying to get your own spectacular off, there's not a hope in hell that from a Nature paper or a Science paper you could construct a virus of this type.
I mean, Richard, there is a fundamental publishing sort of scientific question here about scientific information. You know, it should always be free, right?
Well, I mean, it seems to me this is running over exactly the same sort of ethical and political grounds as the publication of information on how to make an atomic bomb. Exactly the same rules apply. This is all stuff you can now find freely online.
Yeah, good luck trying to build one.
Yes, exactly. You know, I mean, okay, you know, the difficult work is not something that anybody can do in their sort of in their backyard. Ethically, I find this very difficult to take a position on the bigger question of whether there is anything that should be kept back or not, partly because I simply don't know the science here. I don't know whether it is the kind of thing that one might reasonably be able to do. I have to say my gut reaction to this story is that it follows the lines of the classic scare story, that this is another story which is sort of scaring Western populations about what science might do, whether positive or negative. But I find it very difficult to get beneath that sort of surface and to get to grips with the science here, as Kevin was saying.
I mean, it does depart from that usual scare story somewhat in that authorities in the field of virology and particularly influenza research, there have been many vociferous opponents of publishing this material, redacted or otherwise. You know, I found myself flick-flacking on the issue as to whether or not it should be out there.
Robin, as a cynical journalist, do you think that this mutated GM H5N1, which can spread easily amongst people, should ever have been made, never mind published?
Well, it's scientists playing God, isn't it?
I was waiting for someone to say that. I'm glad you said it.
Well, it's a good scare story. I don't knock scare stories. It is a fascinating one, I've got to say. And it's very, you can see both sides of it, and that's the interesting part about it, I think. I mean, the point of doing this is to make it easier from one mammal to infect another mammal, so you can then study the models of how this virus is transmitted and do something about it. I mean, it's not just done for intellectual curiosity. It's done with a very specific aim in mind, is it not?
It absolutely is. And so I found myself thinking, well, of course this should be out there, because actually, initially I thought, well, the bioweapon stuff, and I think still, it is overplayed. It's a rubbish terrorist weapon. It's as likely to kill everybody in your country as it is in the country you're targeting.
Or you, in fact.
And, you know, all it takes is the wrong gust of wind and you've had exactly the opposite effect that you wanted to have. It's not easy to put together, and there are other ways of causing mass destruction that would probably be more straightforward. Then there's some statement, however, on the other hand, that it's unclear how likely it is that nature would find a way to making a mammal-to-mammal transmission efficient. And that was something that I didn't quite realise, that it's not inevitable that this is going to happen immediately through genetic reassortment or mutation, or at least that's some of the commentary that's been out there. On balance, I think that we do face a real risk in the future of a global pandemic that we're going to be struggling to keep up with. And being as prepared as we can before that comes, and knowing as much about the toolbox of the thing that will be attacking us, probably makes sense. And so the balance of benefit is greater than that of risk.
As long as the labs are properly regulated and things don't leak out. I mean, we've never seen a virus leak out of a lab, have we?
Not in this country.
No, not in this country. No, there are all sorts of things. You know, they're very safely kept, aren't they?
But that's a serious question. How many killer viruses from, and I'm not talking about just virus in general, level 4 containment, I don't know the answer to that, but how, in the past, there's a lot of stuff that's kept, isn't there? Ebola strains, Lassa strains, all the rest of it. How often have we had an accidental release or a deliberate release of that stuff?
I think the infectious disease experts will know the answer to that, and probably they keep it to themselves, because it's virtually impossible that it hasn't been a serious leak, you know, often.
Birmingham, smallpox?
Well, yeah.
May I just say, I was delighted to read that when it comes to flu, ferrets and humans are very much alike. It's good to see sort of different bits of the animal kingdom being brought into this research.
What, you cough in the direction of a ferret, yeah, it's going to get a cold.
The scientists go and drink in the evening in the sneezing ferret or something like that.
Well, let's continue the medical theme. Richard, the story you've decided to pick is a very sort of blighty-centric one. tell us about the NHS.
Of course, well, nothing more central to the English character than the NHS. And of course, barely a day goes by when it's not in the news in some way, especially over the last couple of years. But a story came out a few days ago that Hinchingbrook Hospital, which is in Cambridgeshire and has been struggling with a great deal of debt, about 40 million worth of debt for some time, has been taken over, or at least is being run by a private firm called Circle. Now, as always with NHS stories of this kind, some people think this is the end of the world and other people think this is the bright new future of the health service.
It depends on which side of the House of Commons you sit on, I think.
Precisely. I mean, as a historian, this takes me straight back to the debates at the start of the National Health Service back in 1948 over exactly what it should provide. What sort of service are we providing here? There were a lot of people at the time making the case that the health service should be almost a sort of military service based on the emergency medical service during the Second World War, that it should essentially provide a basic level of care. It should patch people up, send them back out, and that was the job of the state. But the fact that built into the health service was this commitment to provide absolutely cutting-edge care to everybody free at the point of delivery has really ended up being a kind of worm in the bud for the health service. It's turned it into almost, one is tempted to say, a financial black hole. Now, on the other side of this, as a sort of vaguely lefty Brit, I love the health service. It's saved my life on more than one occasion. And the idea that this commitment to care being delivered free at the point of delivery and the best care being available to everybody, regardless of their ability to pay for it, it breaks my heart to think that is being challenged in some way. So really, I just want to sort of deepen and broaden everybody's confusion about exactly what we should do with the health service and exactly what the solution to the problem is.
No one here thinks of rolling the clock back, surely, to this emergency medical service.
No, indeed. I think part of what's been so central to the health service's appeal is this commitment to care being free at the point of delivery and also equality of care, the fact that everybody in the country can get this very high level of care. So going back is not an issue, as if it ever was an issue. But I think we do, as always with every generation in this country, face the question of what kind of health service do we want? How are we going to remodel this institution?
Kevin, you're an employee of the National Health Service. Is it even possible for someone on the inside like you to give us 2 minutes on what's going on with this potential reorganisation? What are your thoughts? What are you afraid of? You've heard Richard saying, you know, there are all sorts of challenges, but what are you afraid of?
I mean, I am an NHS consultant, but I mean, as an individual, my personal view of this is that you can't be too dogmatic about whether it should be private or public or something that is neither. That as a doctor, you've got to act in the best interest of your patients, and whatever system is going to serve them best is what you should be after. And that kind of is independent of what the great history of the NHS is. But that said, you know, we live in an age of evidence-based medicine, and as far as I can tell from what I've read, there isn't an awful lot of evidence to support the way that we're going at these new reforms. And I've found it difficult to find any independent observer who doesn't have a financial interest in the outcome of the NHS reform bill who says that it's a good idea. At the very least, surely we should be piloting this. This is a huge revision to the health service. And you know, at the very least, we should put a pilot in somewhere rather than just do it to the whole country once and forever.
Just to explain, that's the health bill that's going through the UK Parliament at the moment, which, as you say, people are lining up to oppose, including virtually all of the professional bodies representing doctors. So not the easiest thing for the government at the moment. You can read more about all these stories at the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/science. Robin, let's turn now to your story in this weekend's Observer magazine. Exactly 100 years ago, the scientific establishment was rocked by the discovery of what purported to be the remains of a million-year-old ape man. This fossil showed a human ancestor with a large brain, but a primitive jawbone and teeth. Robin, take us back to that gravel pit in East Sussex in 1912. What was so significant about this find?
Well, the significance for the scientific establishment was that at last we had a primitive ape man that showed that Britain, as well as France and Germany, was in the crucible of human evolution. The French had the Cro-Magnons, the Germans had the Neanderthals and the Heidelbergenses, and it got to the point where actually the French were dismissing us, our archaeologists, as pebble hunters. And they wanted badly to have a find that showed something dramatic had taken place, and they got it from this.
It's always the best way to start a scientific discovery is to sort of have national rivalry.
Yes, I think that's really what undid us in the end. And along comes Charles Dawson, who's known as the Wizard of Sussex because of all the previous finds that he's made in the county, and says, oh, by the way, I was workman from this gravel pit, passed me this big bit of human skull. It looks very ancient. And so he finds more bits, and then they find some bits of two hippopotamus teeth that give a good dating for these finds. They find some stone implements. And then finally they find a piece of carved elephant bone broken in two that when put together again looked awfully like a cricket bat. Nobody at any point there was beginning to think, hello, what's going on here? It was taken up, the species was given a name, Don Man of Dawson. And for 40 years, we firmly believed that the bits of skull, which are in the Natural History Museum at the moment, were of a particular kind of ape man.
It's very tempting, isn't it? An Englishman with a cricket bat, yes. I mean, found a million years old. This shows not only human evolution in action, but also the fact that obviously cricket is something important to English people.
It's in our genes, you know.
It's in our genes. You couldn't have asked for anything better. Very pleased that the Manchester Guardian actually broke this news story in 1912.
1912, yes. Yeah.
Not the first mistake they made, clearly. anyway, so what happened? How did the hoax start to unravel? Because it took until the 1950s, as you say, to become known as a hoax. So how did it happen?
The problem was people wanted to believe that our brains led our evolution, and that quite deep in our past, it was the brains that grew before the other factors. In other words, we stood upright and our brains grew, and we kind of had to find things to do with our hands, so we stood upright and then we started making tools. We were brain driven. In fact, it's not the case. And throughout the 20s and 30s, what we found were, in fact, people standing upright, people making tools maybe 2 or 3 million years old. But the brains were small. Brains came late in human evolution. And all around the world, people were finding evidence, no sign of big brain evolution at all, until very late in the development of our species. So basically, Piltdown Man stood out there like a sore thumb. And eventually somebody looked at these kind of holy relics, which nobody had really bothered, and found that the teeth had been filed down with a metal file, and it had been stained with crude dyes, and the cricket bat had been carved with a knife. If somebody had spent a day with a microscope, they'd have spotted it. It was a fake. But we chose not to. We didn't look, because we didn't want to find the truth.
And who was implicated? I mean, you mentioned Charles Dawson seems likely, but how did Arthur
Yeah, he's Cohen... got more form than Professor Moriarty. I mean, everything he found, this Wizard of Sussex had found, was subsequently proved. Miles Russell at Bournemouth University has done a great study in all his previous finds, and he faked everything. Now the question is, was he used by other people at the Natural History Museum, or was he used by Arthur Conan Doyle, who played golf?
How did he get into it? Yeah.
Well, he played golf there, so he must be guilty. You see, he actually played golf at Piltdown. He did apparently have a grudge against science, because he was a spiritualist and they kind of sneered in these beliefs. And he says in his novel, The Lost World, which appears in 1912, that in fact it's terribly easy to fake an ancient bone, which people seize on it. This is fantastic. Look how he's evolved. Really, if he was involved, why didn't he announce that he'd tricked the world? And he never did, so one kind of thinks it's not him. But there are several people at the museum who could have been using Charles Dawson. And this is what scientists are now hoping this year, in the centenary year, to find out. They're going to look at some of these different finds. There was a Piltdown 2 found in Sheffield Park. Were these faked by the same people? And there's a guy called Hinton who died in the 70s and was here at the Natural History Museum. And above, in a loft above his desk, they found lots of bones and dyes that he'd been staining these bones. So he's implicated. So get his bag of tricks and do a full chemical analysis using, all the modern equipment that we can, laser spectroscopy, and find out, are there links between Hinton and Dawson, perhaps, or with Arthur Smith Woodward and Dawson, or whatever. I think Dawson is involved, but was he on his own? Was he being used?
Richard, you've got a question.
Yeah, it's not so much a question, more a point. I mean, it's very striking what you said in jest about sort of national rivalries driving these things, but it's so often the case in science that it does come down to, especially in the 19th century, the whole history of bacteriology, for example, is driven by Pasteur, who's a Frenchman who can't stand Koch, the German, and this sort of dominates their relationship for a long time. And if you look at the history of archaeology more generally, the way in which 18th and 19th century imperialists are getting to grips with the archaeologies of the countries they invade, whether it's India or Egypt, there's a lot of rivalry in the sense of looking for the antecedents of one's own culture in the ruins of sort of Egyptian Memphis, or in the Gissings Observatory, the places like this. There's a wonderful series of lectures given by Simon Schaffer up at Cambridge called the Tana Lectures, which you can download. But Schaffer gets really into the ways in which imperial culture sort of project their history onto the people that they conquer.
Is there a lot of faking going on elsewhere as well?
I couldn't possibly comment. Certainly not in history of medicine.
So, Robin, when can we sort of expect to get some results?
The anniversary goes like this. It's in February that Dawson writes to the Natural History Museum and says, I've got these bones. There's going to be a meeting this autumn at which the findings for the study will be announced, and what will the results be, and what conclusions that we can draw, and what links we can make about who done it.
So 100 years later, we might actually get to correct this this error.
Can we actually see the Piltdown bones on
yes,
display?
Yes, you will be able to. Not normally in public, but I'm very sure that the Wellcome Trust in March is going to display them. They've got an exhibition coming up, so you can go along and see them. But it's the interesting thing about the fragments that none of them actually link together. It's very carefully faked so that you can't see how these pieces might have attached. They're all individual pieces. And the bit where the jawbone is attached to the skull, is that mysteriously is not there either. So, you know, it's the things that were missing that actually scream louder than the things you actually find.
Do you think it was just a different time when people were less likely to doubt scientists? Do you think that's what it was?
I think you're quite wrong. I mean, you look at the struggles over the controversies and debates over evolution in the 19th century. I mean, science was not beyond question in this period. I think you have to look elsewhere for explanations of this. But it's
That was a very novel theory that was being proposed then. It's accepted dogma now.
And on that bombshell, calling
I'm
natural
gonna get Richard
selection
Dawkins in now. What have I done?
Well, Robin McKee's piece, The Piltdown Hoax, is in this week's Observer magazine. It's also on observer.co.uk as well, if you would prefer to read it online. Well, that's all we have for this week. My thanks to Robin McKee, Kevin Fong, and Richard Barnett. The producer this week was Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.